Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for John Craven's news round. In the news. Welcome to In the News, our regular look at what's been going on.
I'm a bit upset
that you didn't get a moment. It fits better with Stevens.
Yeah, Adrian Mole's diary.
Yeah, well,
that would work.
We could go with that. Well, as you probably heard, we have John Stevens, our National Director here. Good morning, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
Yeah, you're very happy with yourself.
I was pleased with that, wasn't I? I'm even happier with this one. It's been a busy week for you guys listening to Taylor Swift's new album. No? You've been elsewhere?
No. I did grow up with John Craven, though. News
did
round.
You?
Yeah, as a kid.
I've been listening to Beyonce's new album.
Have you?
Yeah, so there.
Well done. Cultural reference.
Cultural pipe and smoke
it. Excellent work. But in all seriousness, it has been a busy week. Lots been going on in the work and ministry of the FIEC. Adrian, just tell us, you've been at a couple of our local conferences. Tell us about where they've
and,
been.
It's worth saying, and we'll see this, not just a lot going on in FIEC, but there's a lot going on in the Christian world.
Yes.
Things ramp up after Easter. It's kind of a busy period for lots of people, lots of different conferences, events that are put on, because we hope it gets a bit warmer and drier. Ha, ha, ha.
Frost on the car this morning.
Yeah, that's right. I've been at three local conferences this week. I've been at two of them. So on Wednesday, I was in Stoke. It was great to be at Park Church in Stoke and just hear how that church is growing in really remarkable ways. Having to go to two services permanently on a Sunday morning. They think they've doubled in size since COVID.
Great.
Seeing there what we're seeing over and over again, there seems to be a real hunger for spiritual things. And people are being converted. Mm. People are coming from churches where they've been poorly taught and want to be taught. So the same narrative is getting repeated over and over again to a greater or lesser extent. I don't think we need to put a label on it, but God is at work. I think that's fairly clear. So really encouraged by that. That was in Stoke. There was also one in Newtown, Mid Wales.
Same day.
Same day. And then Thursday I was down in Cardiff. And again, hearing some of the same stories from people about what the Lord is doing and how the Lord is at work.
Fantastic. And John, you've been serving in different contexts this week?
This week and last week, I've been actually two different conferences, both of which have been actually for preachers, helping people to kind of develop their preaching skills. So last week, I was at the kind of Proclamation Trust Men in Ministry conference up at the Hayes in Swanwick with a group. And then this week, I was doing something similar for the London Gospel Partnership through the London kind of preachers conference. It was actually great to be together with sort of guys with regular preaching ministries in church, a really good mix of Anglicans, FIEC, and other free church people in those groups. But people are absolutely committed to Scripture as the Word of God and believing that God speaks through the Scriptures as we proclaim them, and helping to think through how we do that, how we can do that better, how we can improve. I was doing some material on Hebrews,
for
both groups. Mm. And then actually in both cases, kind of leading a group, helping people with their preaching. So in one group, we were working through Hebrews. In the others, we were listening to people's recently preached sermons and kind of then commenting on those. Interesting in that final kind of conference, I hadn't expected this. We were a man down in my group. So actually my sermon from Bethel Church in Farnham on Sunday, we used as the final one. So the group got the chance to listen to me on Acts 10.
So you were in the chair.
Which was really helpful, actually. I don't often listen to my own preaching, and it is helpful to have other people's kind of response to it. I was most struck by, I've got various verbal tics that go with the way that you speak, and you don't even realize you're doing it. And you listen to it, and it's really helpful to think, actually, that is really annoying when you hear it over the course of a sermon. And so just have to kind of work harder to avoid that. So it was a helpful thing.
Fantastic.
So I want to ask John, quick 30 seconds and no more.
Oh.
Why should preachers who are listening or people leading Bible studies think about teaching Hebrews?
Okay.
Often talk about the news, but let's just quickly just take it aside. Is that right?
Absolutely fine. I'm fascinated to hear
because it is a great book.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can do that in 30 seconds. Hebrews is a brilliant book. I think it actually speaks into a very contemporary situation. The message of the book is basically about people drifting away from Christian faith because they are under pressure from the society around them. So actually, I think the book's message is very relevant in our context. Its basic message is Jesus is better than whatever it was you came from or you could turn to. So in multiple ways, just grasping that Jesus is better. So it's a very Jesus-centered book. And I think from that point of view, it's hugely helpful for Christians to anchor their faith and enable them to resist those pressures. Alongside that, it's a book that I think is actually crucial for understanding how the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together.
Right.
It's basically kind of a worked understanding of the relationship between Old Covenant and New Covenant. And it opens windows on how we should read the whole of the Old Testament. I I in fact, in my groups, were using it as a sort of a, as a model of expository preaching as well, because I think actually Hebrews is a book that follows the form of a sermon, probably about four major sermons, and it teaches us a lot about the nature of preaching, the nature of God's word, confidence in it as the living and active word of God. So there are multiple reasons. I think Hebrews is a neglected book. Mm. It's at least as important as the letter to the Romans. Often we think of Hebrews as being primarily about the finished work of Christ, which it is. When I was preparing for it, what really struck me is that Hebrews is also very much about the ongoing work of Christ. Christ as the high priest who is interceding on behalf of us, and that we can come to him for grace and help. So I think sometimes the Reformation perspective has meant a narrowed view of what Hebrews teaches. Mm. Whereas actually it's really encouraging to believers to know that Jesus we can come to for the help we need.
You were right, you couldn't do it.
But there's your next preaching series.
And it's worth this is a kind of newsy thing. We didn't plan this, Phil, but I want to tell you anyway. The Gospel Coalition have released a new resource in this last week, which is an update of and Don Carson used to have two little books, the sort of best commentaries on every book. Mm. And people will hear that and say, well, you know, what commentaries should I read on Hebrews? Where should I go? And they've updated that into an online free resource, which is excellent. I had a very, very small part in contributing to some of the parts of it. So basically, you can go and look up a book and you can see some recommended commentaries, because there are so many to choose from. You know, if I'm preaching Hebrews, where could I go? Mm. Where's an entry-level commentary? Where's a kind of more complex commentary? Mm. So really helpful resource. We'll put the link in the show notes.
I think Adrian's being a bit bashful today. He has contributed the commentary on Numbers to that. And actually, in the recent kind of Gospel Coalition best commentaries, Adrian featured twice in the section on Numbers for his kind of book on Proclamation Trust. I'm working on Numbers, and Adrian's book's really helpful.
Fantastic. Yeah. So there we are. So for those who are listening and not watching, Adrian has gone red, but there we are. Very, 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 very good. just very briefly, next week it's Thrive and the Ministry Wives Retreat, obviously all booked up now for women
Thrive
in ministry.
Thrive is for women in ministry.
Yeah, and yep. Ministry Wives Retreat, yep. Obviously for Ministry Wives, all booked up now, but do keep that in your prayers. So a lot of planning have gone into this, two significant conferences that we're hosting next week, and do book a place on a local conference.
Yeah, and just worth saying, not everybody is obviously... Not every wife is coming along. Mm. If you are married, not everyone who's in ministry is married. But if you are married, whether you're a woman in ministry and you're married to a man, or whether you are a man in ministry, married to a woman, actually the care of spouses of those who are serving in ministry by churches is really important and often neglected. Yeah. So it's just a good reminder to put that out there.
Absolutely. Well, yesterday I had a fascinating afternoon. So those of you who don't know, we're on a business park in Market Harbour. And just over the way, over the car park, a huge building's been renovated, and it's now the home of the Market Harbour Building Society.
What's their three-year mortgage rate, Phil?
Yeah, well, I don't know. But I was invited to the opening, and it was really good to go and meet some people on the business park. But what was fascinating, which links us into our first story, is how the Christian values of the founder really helped him to set up the building society in 1870s. This was a guy called John Newcomb. And essentially what he wanted to do was make property ownership possible for the masses. So he was buying up land, putting in kind of sewage systems and drainage systems, all that kind of stuff, so that then the houses could be built on and people could afford them. But interestingly, he was a deacon in a Baptist church in a village just outside Harbour in Clipston.
There's an article on the website about that Baptist church.
Indeed.
Because there was a revival which he was born out of.
Absolutely. So his Christian principles drove him to make these decisions and set up this building society for the benefit of others, which I just thought was a really interesting link. And I think it links us to the death of Frank Field this week, great parliamentarian politician who his Christian principles shaped the causes he was passionate about. And I just wanted to say, I want to pay tribute to Frank Field, because I think he was a great parliamentarian. I used to work on the Wirral, and he would only ever do interviews with us about things he was passionate about. He wasn't a self-promoting politician in any way, shape or form. But if he believed in a cause, he would want to back it.
He was principled, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was great. Yeah.
I was very struck from his obituary. Christianity had clearly informed what it was he stood for. He was kind of passionate about wanting to bring about welfare reform that genuinely helped people. He served for a short period of time in the kind of Department of Work and Pensions as a minister under Tony Blair. He'd worked for the Child Poverty Action Group. But it was interesting. He'd started out actually as a young conservative. That was where he kind of began, and then sort of became sort of a Labour councillor and ultimately a kind of an MP. But he did have this independent mind in which he kind of was, in a sense, his Christian principles shaped what he thought about policy. It also shaped his relationship relationships. Mm. So he had, for example, a remarkably close relationship with Margaret Thatcher. Mm. He respected her in lots of ways. He didn't necessarily agree with her on everything, but there was a strong personal relationship with her. I was quite strong. He actually, when she lost her first vote for kind of retaining the leadership or didn't get a clear victory, he went to see her to urge her to resign, just on a sort of a personal level. There was that level of friendship. Mm. He kept visiting her. Actually into her dementia.
She went to his retirement.
Indeed.
Didn't she? It was virtually the last thing she ever went to.
So that was very striking. He then resigned from the Labour Party over its failure to deal with anti-Semitism. Mm. He regretted that he'd supported Corbyn for the leadership because he thought that was about democracy, but then he saw the results of that. So he was willing to admit his mistakes and his kind of failings. So I think he stands out as a man of integrity. Essentially, he became what he described himself as an independent Labour MP. Yeah. And actually, the obituary said that actually some sort of people in the party said, well, that's what you've always been, kind of frank. But I think there's something there, actually. A Christian who wasn't prepared to sacrifice his principles for high office and stood consistently and integrity and in many ways was honoured across the whole political spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And as an independent, interestingly, an independently minded guy, there are some lessons for independent leaders. Obviously, there are principle lessons, I think. We can look to secular leaders, and in God's common grace, and amazing grace, in fact, in the world, we can see principles for integrity and that kind of thing, the way people conduct themselves. But actually, here was someone who didn't, you know, who didn't kind of accept rules from above, if you like, that the Labour Party were imposing on him, although he agreed with the overall principles and wanted the freedom to apply some of those in a way that he saw was fit. And in a way, you know, as leaders in independent churches, there are certain things that are non-negotiable that we take because we're Christians and we allow the Lord to rule our lives in a loving and helpful and wise way. Mm. But we're allowed latitude and we want to be principled in the way we apply the things we do in local church. And I think seeing the way that Frankfield got on with that in politics, I think is a great encouragement just to leadership in independent churches. We don't all have to be completely the same. We're not denominational. Mm. We all believe the same things and fundamentally have the same principles, but some of them will be worked out in different ways.
Yeah, Frankfield. Yeah.
I think for Christians working in the world, actually there's a lesson there that I think often in Parliament, the MPs who are most committedly Christian tend not to be in positions of high office. No. They tend to actually be working behind the scenes on the back benches, again, because they don't want to compromise their principles to actually sort of serve and support things that they don't agree with. So in a way, they don't necessarily enjoy as much career advancement as others do. But actually, very often, they are respected in the end for their integrity over a long period of time. And I think that is often the experience of Christians engaging in the workplace. They may not attain to the very highest position because they maintain their integrity, but in the long run, that is respected and they can have a very significant impact. Mm.
Frank Field, who's died this week, aged 81. And staying with politics, there's been a bill that's been passed this week on immigration. So this is the Rwanda bill that we've been talking about previously, that kind of thing. That is now going to come into law. That means that flights will take off to Rwanda, the government hopes, in the summer. I don't know what the answer is to the immigration problem, but I was saying to a colleague yesterday, I'm not sure this is the answer. Am I wrong?
Who wants to go first?
Well, I'm not sure we know. And I have lots of sympathy for the government attempting to deal with what is a very difficult problem of illegal immigration, which is actually a worldwide problem. Some of that is people clearly fleeing situations of kind of war and conflict and persecution. Some is also people sort of who are economic migrants who are understandably seeking a better life elsewhere. And I think the situation of people crossing into the UK on small boats across the Channel is desperate. Mm. And we need to recognise it for what it is. It is a wicked trade conducted by people smugglers who don't care about the people they're bringing across. Many of those who are travelling on small boats, they are not necessarily the most vulnerable people from those countries because they've been able to pay very large amounts of money to be transported. So there is clearly a responsibility to care for refugees and provide them with shelter and safety. And I think that the challenge here is that it's easy to see this as a kind of a harsh policy, sending people to Rwanda. Behind it is the desire to try to, I think, end the people smugglers' kind of business. And I think it's right to remember that these people are coming actually largely from France, which is already safe. They could stay there. So people are coming to somewhere else because they want to. And the whole object has been to, in a sense, remove the incentive to kind of take the risk of that journey and mean that the people smugglers can't get money out of people. At one level, I think you can't say that that is in and of itself an immoral policy. It is out of a desire to try to bring to end a kind of a trade which causes people to die and benefits the people smugglers. Australia did a similar thing in dealing with illegal kind of immigration. In terms of this bill, the real problem has been seeking to move people to Rwanda and the question of whether Rwanda is a safe country. And that's been a matter of dispute and debate. The kind of Supreme Court was looking into that. I think many Christians, the problem with this legislation is not necessarily of removing people to Rwanda, but the government has decided to define Rwanda as safe and almost to try to prevent scrutiny of that kind of question.
I mean, it was a letter signed by lots of charities and church denominations basically calling this out. I think well over 100 signatories.
I think the challenge here, as with a lot of political things, Phil, is there is this kind of a Venn diagram of what we should think as Christians and what we think politically. And there's an overlap in the middle where those two things come together. So clearly as Christians, there are Christian principles at stake in how we want to behave and what we would want for a country that we live in and that we would vote for. But then there are political questions about how you implement those principles. So principles of generosity, for example, and welcome and fairness and justice. There are differences of opinion as to how you might implement those. And I think the challenge for us is where we put things that we that are in the political sphere, for example, and make them more spiritual than they are, so they become a test of orthodoxy. And I think this is one of those things that's kind of, it's wavering around the middle. Some clearly some Christian principles at stake. I'm much more cynical than you, I think, John, about the government's motive. I don't just think, it seems to me, it doesn't just seem to be about wanting to end the trade. I think there's a bit of playing to the crowd here. I think there are other things that the government could be doing that aren't, that I'd want to lobby for. But I think those are political conclusions rather than spiritual conclusions. So I think sometimes it's difficult to navigate between these things. There was an extraordinary moment last night in Question Time where Chris Philp, the policing minister, was asked, what about a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a neighbouring country to Rwanda, and on the border at war with Rwanda? So what would happen if the person came over and was deported to Rwanda, a country that's trying to kill him on the border? And Chris Philp seems to have suggested in his response, he didn't realise that Democratic Republic of Congo is a separate country from Rwanda, which all feels a bit muddled and rushed, which is why I'm a bit more cynical. It looks like there's a bit of playing to the crowd here. And I do worry that, and Macron said this week, I don't normally quote Emmanuel Macron, but he said this week, it does smack a bit of recolonization if we're not careful. And I think there's some truth in that as well. So I agree with John. I think there are things that need to be done. I'm just not persuaded that this is it.
It's worth saying a lot of churches have a really good ministry to those seeking asylum as well.
And have been greatly enriched by people coming in.
Well, I mean, I think that's what it is. The policy debate is, what's the best way to prevent this terrible problem of people being smuggled? I think what disturbs me more is a more general public attitude towards migrants and those who have come to the UK. The vast majority of people who are migrating to the UK are actually legal migrants coming from a wide variety of different cultures.
600,000 net migration, and we're talking about 30,000, are we crossing?
Even those who might have come illegally, once they've arrived in the UK, often their asylum claims are granted. So I think it's understandable that there is a public reaction against those who seem to have kind of, in a sense, arrived unfairly and wrongly. But that's a relatively small number compared to the bigger issue. But there is clearly a hostility to the whole idea of migration. And I think as Christians, we need to deal with that. That actually policy on reducing migration or avoiding illegal migration can actually be a cover for a hostility to people from other cultures. I'm reading a history of Britain in between 1974 and 1979 at the moment, and actually exactly the same arguments were being made. That, you know, too many migrants, the result is the country will be changed, it's no longer ours, it's not the same as it once was. Actually, those arguments are made
It's just again racism,
and again.
Isn't it?
A lot of it is racism, although it's about people's loss of their cultural identity. It's their communities becoming different.
So xenophobia, really, but, rather than...
I mean, the irony is, of course, that some of those that were being objected to in the 1970s were the East Asian kind of East African Asians who had come to the UK, who are now often quite vociferous about wanting to prevent kind of migration. So I think that there are attitudes of how we view other people of other cultures that the gospel deeply challenges.
Yeah.
So whatever our view on the particular policy, I think as Christians, we want to be sort of, in a sense, avoiding that kind of sort of attitude towards those of other cultures, which is basically sub-gospel.
We will get a general election sometime soon. Mm-hmm. And I think this just highlights one of the challenges is we often focus in on policies which are enacted to fix a particular problem. But actually, there are often systemic issues that aren't really addressed. And I think we need to be asking our politicians questions about systemic issues. Mm. So, for example, the Rwanda bill talks about safe routes and people choosing safe routes into the country, which is basically you apply for asylum outside of the country and come in. But actually, it's almost impossible in some countries to apply for asylum at all. Mm. So there are systemic issues that mean people choose other routes which are unsafe. So I think the problem is we're looking at a fix without really ever talking about some of the deep issues. And I think that's true across a lot of politics. Mm. And I think as Christians, perhaps we've got to be challenging politicians on some of the deeper rooted issues.
Just two things. As we think about this and engage with it, remember to pray for governments that have been put there by God. I mean, these are massively difficult problems that they're wrestling with. You want to pray that they would kind of approach it with integrity, with a kind of a genuineness, that it wouldn't simply be playing to the gallery. So I think pray for those that are kind of leading. And I think as we engage in debates on these things, it's easier to criticize. Let's think about whether we do think there is a viable alternative that will really resolve the issue. Because you can say, we don't like that policy, but unless you actually have the ability to say, well, here is something better and it will work. So I think very often people don't like things and they have a rather naive view of something else is obviously going to solve the problem. Often that may not be the case, or it may have been tried. I think we have to sort of in assess in the round, not just critique the thing.
Let's move on. A lot of this will, these kind of things need to be picked up by leaders. So let's talk about leadership for a few minutes. So two leaders, one former leader, one current leader that have been in the news in recent days. Our former Prime Minister Liz Truss, as she promotes her book. She's written a book, a certain number of times to save the West, I think it's called.
10 years.
10 years, is that right? Next decade is crucial. And then Hamza Yousaf, who's the Scottish First Minister, who's been in the news this past sort of 36 hours or so. Two very different kind of styles of leadership, but actually, I think lessons to learn from both of them. Let me throw my £10 in. It seems to me that Liz Truss is trying to justify her premiership in her book, so she's self-justifying what she did in government. And it seems Hamza Yousaf just hasn't really thought about what the consequences were going to be of his actions. So he came out of a meeting yesterday morning, pleased that he'd ended his coalition with the SNP and the Green Party. But by the end of the day, he's facing a vote of no confidence. Lots of lessons, I think, brothers.
Oh, goodness. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with Mrs. Truss.
I haven't read the book.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I've read a few excerpts from it. It does look like it's an exercise in self-justification. She obviously had a very short premiership, and I think she wants to come back into frontline politics. She wants to sort of justify her position. So there's a bit. It seems like there's a bit of doubling down. It's all about other people and what they've done rather than what she has or hasn't done.
Just by the way, on that, when my fixed rate on my mortgage ends, I'm going to have to find another £250 a month to pay my mortgage from the beginning of next year.
You are, although it's very difficult to speculate about what the mortgage rate might be today if Liz Truss hadn't brought in her budget. So
I lay it at the door of the mini budget. Maybe I'm wrong to do that.
I'm sure you do, Phil. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. And it's nice to have people to blame for these things, which actually, I mean, you're doing there exactly what she's doing in her book, which is she's finding, you know, lots of
other
things
people,
to blame.
And things.
I just think the whole question of self-justification is interesting because clearly her premiership was something of a disaster. And she wouldn't have been got rid of so quickly. It was an extraordinary amount of time, really, that it all happened in. But an exercise in self-justification, I think, is pretty ugly. Mm. And in the way that it's been done, it's also very transparent. The bits of the book you've read and the headlines you've seen, it's clear what she's trying to do. And I think that is part of the sinful nature. We've been thinking about this, actually, our local conferences, wanting to prove ourselves, wanting to justify ourselves. That's part of the sinful nature. Mm. And actually, the gospel frees us from that. And as we've been working through this at the local conferences, interestingly, I found it quite a painful conference to lead, because every time I'm putting my heart on the line and trying to apply the teaching to myself, I realize actually these are quite deep rooted sins that all of us carry, sort of the desire to and the feeling that we have to justify ourselves. But I think the gospel frees us from that. And I just want to say that was wonderfully liberating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't say I have sympathy for Liz Truss. I mean, at one level, she didn't get a very big advance for the book, which meant that people didn't think that it was necessarily going to sell. I also haven't kind of read it. But I do think she must, in one level, you kind of wonder whether does she regret the way she handled her premiership? Because she was handed this opportunity to be prime minister. She had a vision for how things needed to change. And at one level, she raises some very important questions about kind of the challenges that are faced for the future. She proposes a different set of solutions to those. But it's quite clear that she kind of sought to enact all of that immediately in a kind of a very rapid way, without necessarily taking account of all of the implications of that. It seems extraordinary that they weren't aware of, for example, the implications for pension funds of what they were doing in terms of the budget that they introduced. And that at one level, the book is self-justificatory, and there's almost seems to be little in the way of recognition of having actually, in a sense, brought that on herself by the way that it was done, and then a casting of blame to others on that score. But as leaders, that kind of having a strong view and kind of moving way, way too quickly, not understanding all of the circumstances and not taking people with you is a common kind of problem from which we can learn. And one of us, she seems to have little insight that is what happened, and she contributed to that.
I guess Hamza Yusuf's done something similar in terms of leaping to a decision which is then backfired very quickly.
Yes, I mean, he was in a coalition government, leading a coalition government that had a very strong green agenda to it, because of the Green Party had a number of seats, 8 seats, I think. And they had a formal agreement, so it had boundaries set and limits set. He wasn't happy with that. And so that seems to have come to an end very abruptly. And then that will challenge his position. I think the Conservatives are going to introduce a no confidence vote.
Be next week, I think.
Be next week. So who knows what will happen there. But I think, you know, it's interesting. A lot of leadership is not, perhaps the compromise isn't the right word, but it kind of is coalition. You're bringing together people with different views and different opinions. You know, we've seen even someone like Frank Field in the Labour Party, but, you know, not agreeing with everything the Labour Party does. So a lot of leadership is bringing people together who have core beliefs about things, but will differ around the edges. And I think clearly he's just not been able to manage that. And I think that, you know, reflects on the party, probably reflects on him to some extent.
I think so. I mean, he did become leader in very difficult circumstances for the SNP after sort of a long period of government, increasing problems, obviously kind of issues with his predecessor that have kind of continued
still going
to emerge
on,
the challenges that are there. It seems to me there are some fundamental issues about the SNP and his leadership of it, which again are relevant to church context. So the challenge for the SNP is it's not necessarily a politically coherent party. At one level, it exists to promote Scottish independence. But within the SNP, you have a very wide diversity of political views. So the SNP has always encompassed people who come from a more left-wing socialist perspective and people who come from a more conservative, kind of socially conservative perspective. And they held together by a common desire that Scotland be independent. If Scotland were independent, the SNP would split into separate parties that would have very different agendas for how to run Scotland. So he's trying to hold together a coalition. And I think one of the things that's happened is that being in government, they've actually lost a bit of perspective on what the core mission of the SNP is. So I think Alex Salmond has criticised from the outside that one of the problems here is losing the focus on independence instead of pursuing a raft of other policies, including socially kind of liberal policies and, as he would describe it, culture war policies. So actually one of the presenting challenges that caused the SNP to have difficulty is their transgender self-identification, which led Ash Reagan to leave. The social conservatives in the SNP clearly don't agree with that either. But essentially what's happened is the core message has been lost in the pursuit of these culture war things, and that's beginning to bear fruit in the ability to hold it together. I think that's a real lesson for churches, because I think where we are at the moment, actually churches are inevitably a coalition of people with a diversity of views but united in some core convictions. It's TRIB FIC, not just of local churches. And at one level, if we lose sight of the core purpose of the gospel, actually that will cause the coalition to fracture. Mm. And I think actually the whole culture war thing is exactly an issue on which Christians at the moment are in danger of getting dragged into making culture warring a priority over gospel ministry. And actually the result of that will basically be division, and that coalitions that were united primarily in common gospel convictions will find it harder to hold together, will find it harder to have leadership that holds them together, simply because the other things have been raised to the priority. There is a sense in which maintaining unity requires some self-denial over other things that you might feel strongly about, but they're not the core thing. And I think he's probably not managed that particularly well.
Very wise advice, John. Let's just finish with a quick story about Blackpool, where our leaders' conference is being held this year. You can book online, £235 before the end of June. But this is a story that the days of Blackpool Rock could be numbered.
This is possibly, I don't know why you've left it till the end.
We should have gone in with this. Story. Yeah.
So who Blackpool Rock is at risk from Chinese imports. Who knew?
Absolutely.
That it would be worthwhile making Blackpool Rock in China and shipping it to the UK. But it turns out it is.
Well, it's quite an art. I've been reading about
it. It is quite an art. There are the number of factories that have that make rock now in the UK reduced to about 10, all in Blackpool. And the industry is really under threat. And they make rock not just for Blackpool, but for other places, but primarily for Blackpool because of cheap Chinese imports. Mm. It's just fascinating, really, that someone has looked at the UK market and said, we've got to get into that market.
I love the fact there's evidently an art in lettering the middle of Blackpool Rock, which I just never realised before. And there's only about 30 people in Blackpool who can still do it. And if
Clanfair
it's lost,
PG
it's lost.
Doesn't have rock, you've noticed. No.
So you make it by making it very big, and then they smaller shrink it down. Smaller. It is an extraordinary process.
I mean, it does seem a great shame that sort of local business, which has deep connections to a locality, is being undermined by something that's being shipped around the world in a way that presumably is ecologically unsound. So I'm not such a pure capitalist. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a great loss.
It's synonymous with the town.
Blackpool. Come to Blackpool, Phil. Yeah. Buy some proper Blackpool rock.
Yes.
Not a Chinese import. We're for Blackpool rock.
What I want to know is, do you think we can have one for the leaders' conference?
FIEC.
Could we have a stick of rock which says FIEC 2024 and actually give to delegates?
Now we've promoted it, I'm sure we can.
There's really something there for us.
You'd struggle to fit in the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches, wouldn't you, John? That would be a little bit too
would,
much.
But I think FIEC we can manage.
Very good. Well, on that note, it's time to end. Brothers, thank you so much, and thank you for listening to our dive into the news this week. Do rate or leave a review if you found it helpful so others can find it, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Phil.
Have a good weekend. Thanks.